Welcome to the program. I'm Jeff Shekman. In today's digital era, the unseen threads of algorithms intricately weave through our daily lives, significantly molding our preferences, decisions, and worldviews. At the core of our modern digital technology, algorithms curate almost every aspect of our online experience, from the articles we read to the music that we listen to, and even the social interactions we engage in. This pervasive influence has streamlined cultural diversity and complexity, ushering us into a domain that my guest Kyle Shaka aptly terms filter world. In this realm, our experiences are increasingly filtered through data-driven formulas, aiming not just to predict, but to shape our desires. This often leads to a uniform culture, stripped of the chaos and ingenuity that are part of human creativity. Kyle Shaka is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He's written extensively on the impact of digital technology on culture, and his latest work is Filter World, How Algorithms Flatten Culture. It serves as a pivotal examination of how algorithmic governance has permeated our cultural fabric. Kyle explains how algorithms, despite their convenience, provoke crucial debate over the essence of free will and the reality of choice in an environment where preferences are meticulously curated by complex and often inscrutable computational models. It is my pleasure to welcome Kyle Shaka here to talk about Filter World, How Algorithms Flatten Culture. Kyle, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. That was a really lovely description.
Well, thank you. It is great to have you here. In many ways, we once upon a time thought algorithms were going to make our life not just more convenient, but give us more options, that we would see more things, that we would have more opportunity to explore things that would interest us. In many respects, just the opposite has happened. Talk about that in a general sense first.
I think so. I mean, the rise of algorithms has really followed the rise of the internet as this mainstream experience. And I think that really happened over the 2000s and 2010s. And initially, algorithmic recommendations were a great way to filter the internet, to figure out what it was you were actually looking for, like the Google search algorithm, for example. But I think over the 2010s, particularly, all of these digital platforms that we make our lives on now, from Facebook to TikTok to Instagram to Netflix even, they've all kind of been overtaken by recommendations. And so these platforms are constantly trying to guess what it is we're looking for even before we look for it. They're always serving us pieces of content that are already deemed to be appealing to us. They're kind of trying to read our minds and think our thoughts before we do. And I think that that system has just become too inescapable at this point. And it's actually lessening the diversity of our experience rather than improving it.
Is part of the issue that the system is not as sophisticated as it could be? That when you layer on, maybe going forward, layer on things like more sophisticated AI into that, that it will give us more choices, that it has been limited in some respects by the technology?
It has certainly been limited. And I don't think algorithms themselves are inherently flawed or inherently negative. It's just a kind of technology that exists now. But I think what they've been really limited by is the profit motive of the companies that use them. So when we're on Facebook or Twitter, X or TikTok or Netflix even, what that company is trying to do is just keep us engaged, keep us paying attention to what's on there. And it's ultimately not necessarily about giving us the most interesting content, but instead serving us what's most likely to fit within what it already understands to be our taste, to provide something that's not that objectionable, that you're not going to skip forward on, for example, on a Spotify playlist. So I think the incentives are not aligned for the best user experience. There could be an incentive to provide us with the most moving, amazing art that's going to change our lives. But right now, the metric that they're working toward is just keeping our attention and then selling more advertising on that.
How much of the blame rests with us, with a certain degree of laziness and a certain willingness to just give in to the algorithm?
Yes, we don't have to be on any of these platforms. It's really worth reminding everyone. that you don't have to be on Facebook, you don't have to stream television on Netflix, but we do choose to day in and day out. And I'm certainly guilty of that myself. So in one way, there's this user choice that feeds into the system. We're all on all of these platforms. And so that's how they've influenced our lives so much. But I also think we're not, you know, we can't blame ourselves for that because they really have taken over so many aspects of our lives.
But certainly on things like Netflix, and not to put too fine a point on it, but then Netflix or Spotify or what have you, that we can dig deeper, we can look further, we can dig out and examine things that might interest us more or might be different or might surprise us. But instead, we kind of go along with the algorithm because it's easier.
Right. I mean, there's this surface level, superficial consumption that happens with algorithmic recommendations. So if you think about Netflix, what's on your Netflix homepage is dictated by their algorithmic recommendations. So it's trying to guess what you want to see. And often that process is very flawed. Like, it's not necessarily serving you the most personalized content. It's rather giving you what's convenient or what's new or what's popular for other users. And if you can dip below that surface and kind of go hunting on your own, then you can absolutely dig up really interesting stuff. But just personally, whenever I try to search on Netflix, it's one of the worst experiences I have with any technology. It's like they don't want me to find anything. You can't even search for food shows. Like, it's almost impossible to find something on Netflix that you don't know already exists.
In many ways, it's all very self-perpetuating because it creates this, as you talk about in Filter World, a homogenization of taste.
Yeah, I do think there's this flattening effect. And I think in part it's because these platforms have collected so much of humanity at once into their boundaries. Like, Facebook has 1 billion users, TikTok has, you know, over 1 billion users. And so we're all kind of floating within the same digital ecosystem. And because of algorithmic recommendations, the content that we drift toward is often what the kind of content that the most other people have already drifted toward. Like, I think one of the rules of the space is what gets engagement, what gets popular, gets more engagement and becomes more popular. So there's this effect where what we see most often is what the most other people have already seen. And I think that leads to a kind of averageness, like a lowest common denominator quality to a lot of what we see.
In many ways, it's the same way that Google search works in terms of PageRank.
Right. So PageRank ranks pages according to their relevance to what you're trying to find. And so that's sorting content for you in a way. But I do think even Google PageRank has become really flawed over time because so many websites have tried to game that system and do search engine optimization to the extent that the content doesn't really serve us that well anymore. And often the results that you get at the top of Google are not the most authentic web pages, but instead the sites that have optimized their content the best. And it might even be AI generated or something. It's harder to tell what's high quality at this point.
Is there any reason to think that greater sophistication that may come from AI in a year or two or more is going to change any of this in any kind of positive way or perhaps even in a negative way?
Well, my hope for AI is that it can make technology more personal to each user, because when an AI model is trained on a particular set of data, it can keep individualizing itself. It can keep getting more adapted to a certain niche purpose. So I think you can see that with people's AI chatbots or the kinds of like tasks that they have ChatGPT do. But I also worry that generative AI is kind of on its way to replace a lot of user-generated media or professionally generated media. So rather than driving us to a great podcast, for example, or a great article, instead, these AI tools will just spit back a summary of that thing and we'll stop there. And if audiences stop there, then media companies and individual creators are going to have a really hard time making money and sustaining their careers.
Talk about the way the nexus between this algorithmic world that we're talking about and social media.
social media at this point is inseparable from algorithmic recommendations. So almost every social media network that you are on is driven by a recommender system that sorts the content for you. So if you think about like back when Twitter or Facebook first started in the late 2000s or early 2010s, when they were becoming more mainstream, your feed was chronological. It was just a list of things, you know, in the order that they were posted. But in the middle of the 2010s, a lot of those tech companies shifted to more algorithmic feeds, which meant that they were trying to guess what you wanted to see, and it didn't let you choose so much. And at this point, I think with the advent of TikTok, most feeds have become more algorithmic than not. There's this theory that users don't really want to choose what to see. Like they want to be told. We want to be passive consumers. And I think that's true to an extent. Like it's easier to be passive than it is to actually seek things out.
Talk about the impact that you see this having, and you talk about this in Filter World, the impact it's having on arts in general, on music and art and writing, and how it seems to be playing out if we look at the past 5-10 years as an example.
Well, right now, when we step back, so much of our cultural consumption, I think, is mediated through these feeds. So we listen to music on Spotify, we watch TV on Netflix, we consume a lot of visual culture on Instagram. And so the algorithmic feeds and recommendations of these platforms are really dictating how we consume these things and what we consume. So when you're kind of drifting along these pathways, you're getting fed pieces of content. And the kinds of content and culture that you're getting are the ones that fit best in that platform and follow a tech company's priorities at a given moment. So a good example of that might be how Instagram, you know, in the late 2010s, shifted from prioritizing still images to prioritizing video content in a way to keep up with TikTok. So if you didn't follow that jump, if you as a creator or an artist or a musician didn't start posting videos, then you kind of got lost and you couldn't find an audience anymore.
What have you seen in terms of the differences in how all of this plays out between boomers, perhaps, that were not digital natives, that came to this later in life and are dealing with it now, versus Gen Z and millennials that are digital natives and whose life is much more curated by algorithms?
It's true. I mean, as a millennial, I kind of grew up in my adult life on the internet, and a lot of my experiences were shaped by these platforms. So as a journalist, for example, I started my career being on Twitter and getting people's attention by posting on there and talking to my peers on there. And so that really shaped a lot of my career and how I think of the profession of writing. So I think Gen Z and millennials, we've kind of grown up with these systems, and we've kind of gotten inducted into them in a way. Like, we don't know anything else. When I talk to younger internet users, like Gen Z or younger, they don't know a time before social media when the internet was more intentional and more DIY and more diverse in a way. So I think they don't see that there can be a different way of experiencing this. Whereas I think older generations are much more familiar with how culture and information can work in a non-algorithmic, non-social media way.
So I guess the question is there, looking at it from that perspective, is there a way to keep algorithms on the one hand, because they're going to be around, there's no getting away from it, but in some ways do it in a way that really is more reflective of the world before it was so highly curated?
Right. I think there is a way. I mean, algorithms as a technology, as you said, are really necessary. Like, there's too much on the internet. There's too much stuff out there for it not to be filtered in some way. So we need some system for doing that. But there's a lot of ways that these can be improved, I think. I mean, right now we have very little way of talking back to our algorithmic feeds and recommendations. We can't change how they work. We can't ask Facebook to send us different things or stop showing us a particular type of content necessarily. So I think there could be ways to make them much more customizable and controllable. And maybe that is where AI can come in to help users kind of take back the control over how their own feeds work without the tech companies having to mediate every single decision that a user makes.
And the other alternative is more competition in terms of platforms.
Yes,
I mean, if everybody is on Netflix or everybody is on Spotify, all of the things that you've been talking about are going to happen. But if, in fact, there are other sites that people can go to for music or other movie sites or book sites, what have you, then there is an opportunity for greater diversity in these regards.
Yeah, there are actually so few options that we have right now. Like, I think one reason that things feel so homogenous is that we're just all on these same few platforms. And that's because of the tech companies' monopolistic actions, I think. I mean, we have Meta, which owns Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp. And then we have Google, which owns an innumerable number of internet companies. And they really stamp out competition. I mean, if a successful startup is emerging out there, delivering something that users want, one of these companies tends to buy it and undermine it or stamp it out. And that means that users don't get that alternative. They can't find something that works in a different way. So I think if the government were essentially to split up these companies and turn them into units competing against each other, then the outcome would be a much better experience for users.
Talk about the global aspect of this, that the homogenization is not just among your friends or in your community or even in the U.S., but this is a global phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in the book, I have a chapter titled Algorithmic Globalization, which I really think is what has happened with these platforms. So with Facebook or with TikTok, this is a new medium, a kind of unprecedented medium that connects a billion people the world over, like from person to person in granular detail. I can connect with an artist in China or a photographer in Brazil or a cafe owner in Sweden with as much intimacy as I could talk to my neighbor. And I think that has just never happened before in the history of human civilization. So this is a kind of turbocharged, very accelerated globalization that's not just about, you know, shipping crates across the ocean or internet cables or telephone lines, but a really intimate interconnection between a huge swath of humanity. And that means that we all influence each other in a much faster and deeper way because we can see what so many other people are doing. And that's why I think trends have become so dominant now. It's a trend filters through the entire swath of Facebook users, like across the world, or a trend will go through Instagram and reach everyone on that platform.
And yet in so many respects, it is counterintuitive that by having this opportunity to communicate around the world, to have this instantaneous ability, should in fact create greater diversity as we're able to see essentially how other people live and see differences, but it is having precisely the opposite effect.
It feels paradoxical, right?
I mean,
it when you step back and think about it, it should work the opposite way. Like, we should be experiencing all these new ideas and different kinds of culture and new communities of people. And yet when I talk to many people on the internet today, they feel like it's homogenous. They feel bored and disinterested by it. They feel like it's actually limiting their horizons, which is a strange concept because you can still find all of that interesting material. But I think the problem is it's not being surfaced by these feeds that dictate so much of what we see. So we're not, that new interesting stuff is available, but it's only available if you dip below that algorithmic surface and you go searching for it on your own and you make sure to sustain that connection. Because another flaw of algorithmic feeds is that it's very hard to hold on to something. Like, it can drift into your sights and your feed and then disappear forever and you may never find it again. So you really need to keep track of what you're looking at and make sure it doesn't escape from you in these algorithmic tides.
I guess the question then is, again, the paradox of this is how do you create an algorithm that is biased towards diversity and difference?
Yes, yes. Yes, I think it's a great question. I mean, in a hypothetical sequel to this book, I would love to speak to a lot of engineers about how algorithmic feeds can result in more diversity. My gut instinct is that it's a certain kind of flaw in how the internet works now. And I think it's changing. I think we're moving away from the massive platforms like Facebook or TikTok into smaller digital communities and smaller platforms. And those smaller platforms have a way of being more diverse, but they also don't reach the same broadcast level as a Facebook or Instagram. So you might reach, 10,000 people with your cool, niche, interesting community, but you're not going to reach the, viral TikTok level of 10 million viewers in an hour.
In many ways, it's circling back to the long tail that everybody talked about at the beginning of the internet.
Yes. So the idea that everything is available online, everyone is uploading a lot of interesting stuff, and you can go search for it. I think the flaw, the reason we didn't get that optimistic version of the long tail is that we're really stuck in the short end of the long tail. Like we're stuck in the asymptotic rise of that curve. We're stuck in the stuff that's the most popular. And that's because algorithmic feeds promote what is most popular and make sure the most possible people see it. And there's less incentive to highlight those small, niche, unique pieces of content.
And that comes back to, you talked about before, the fundamental economic incentive that lies at the heart of it.
Yes, yes. I mean, all of these platforms are driven by advertising. They make money by surveilling the choices that you make, understanding your desires, and then selling that your attention to advertisers. And I think that's almost a fatal flaw in a way, because it prioritizes just getting and sustaining that attention. I think there are other mechanics that can work, like we see with new platforms like Patreon or Substack or Bandcamp for music, when we can have a direct transaction between a viewer and a creator, or like a listener and a musician, then that relationship is much more sustainable and it's financially viable. But again, you lose that like broadcast mechanism. So you're going to reach your fans, but you might not reach a bunch of strangers.
To the extent that that becomes economically viable, and Substack and mm-hmm. Patreon are good examples, maybe that is the future in some respects.
I think so. I mean, I think if you're frustrated with filter world, if you're frustrated with these algorithmic feeds, the best thing you can do is take your attention away from them and start connecting to people you like directly, whether that's reading a newsletter or buying their album on Bandcamp or, buying a book in a way. Like, those are all more sustainable actions and they're better for both the end user and the creator than just, surfing along the TikTok feed.
Kyle Chayka, his book is Filter World, How Algorithms Flatten Culture. Kyle, it's been a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was great.
Thank you.